my dear. Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 226th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a bi-weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as new Mainers. My guest today is Joel Sui. He grew up on a busy urban street in Wan Chai, district of Hong Kong. Joel is a conceptual artist who expresses his concepts in an amazing array of media to include photography, filmmaking, virtual reality, interactive installations, and sound design. He works under the pseudonym Probably Joel, and you can see and hear his work at probablyjoel.com. And when you're working with a conceptual artist, you can do some fresh things. And today, we're going to be visiting on a virtual street in Hong Kong. Can you hear them? The ambient sounds you hear in the background today are all part of Joel's childhood milieu, an expression of that through sound design. Welcome to New Mainers Speak, Joel.
Thanks for having me.
It's so fun.
It is.
We're out of our natural habitat. I know Joel through Mecca. He has spent a lot of time there, and we'll cover that later, but so fun to have you here at the studio.
Thank you.
Your Sounds of Hong Kong are a fabulous way for us to get to travel back with you to your childhood. This is really cool. I wonder if you could tell us about these sounds a little bit before we start.
Yeah, so this is a part of my master's thesis project at Maine College of Art, and this piece is called Untitled Care Package. So the way I presented the work was that I basically found this package, this parcel, I mean, package in America, but it was the last care package I received from home. It's like all worn down, but it's got my address and it's got like, you know, love mom or something like that. And I was thinking to myself, is there any way I could use this kind of memorabilia as a work of art instead of using something that's like perfectly clean, pristine, you know, lives in the gallery setting? And I thought to myself, what if I kind of asked my friends to record a soundscape of where I grew up and embed it into the care package as if the whole idea was all I wanted is just the sounds from home. So I came up with the idea that I had a sound sculpture that was glowing from the inside and it was leaking light. And when you go closer, you can hear this like soundscape as if you're transported to the block where I grew up, which is where we are right now, right?
Yes, it is. I'm going to turn it up. Let's just listen to it for a moment. When you hear these familiar sounds from your childhood home, what kinds of memories do street sounds evoke for you?
You know, like how scent kind of reminds you of a memory. I think the sounds of where I grew up reminds me of the scent and the scenery of where I grew up. So, you know, right now I'm just conjuring memories of, so I live in an open air market, you know, there are like, high rises, and then on the street itself, there's no cars whatsoever. They're all just little stalls. They're selling candy. There are people like saying, hey, come buy your t-shirts here, or your undershirts, buy your toys here, buy, fresh produce, jade, jewelry, all that sorts of stuff.
That's pretty cool. How many floors was your skyrise?
Let's see. I live in a building that has 25 floors, and each floor has 4 apartments. So a total of 100, and I live in a 23rd floor.
That's a lot of people, and that's just one building in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's just like one building of many, and I'm thinking along the lines of, you know, like, most people in Hong Kong don't live alone. Like, land is scarce. You are most likely living with your parents, and there's at least maybe, like, 3 people every apartment, right? That's, what, 300 people, at least, in one skinny building that goes up. So imagine, like, Hong Kong, if I remember correctly, has the most high-rise buildings in the world.
It certainly seems to when you look at a picture of it.
Yeah.
I did some Wikipedia-ing and Google Earthing, and it makes downtown New York City look modest.
It does. I mean, I remember the first time I went to New York City, it was like 2015, so about 3 years since I'd left Hong Kong. And I don't know, I was thinking about, you know, oh man, I'm going to like the Big Apple, and you know, the New York City's like the city. And I'll say I was pretty underwhelmed. I think Chicago has more of a bustling experience than New York City did.
Oh, interesting.
And it was kind of odd that a little bit of snow could delay the subway system. So I was like, wow, that's kind of weak for a major city, huh?
Well, you have no snow in Hong Kong, correct?
That's true. But we have typhoons.
Yes, that probably could delay a subway system.
Mm-hmm.
Do subways run right on time in Hong Kong?
Not always, but they run significantly more frequently than in New York. So while we don't have 24/7 subway, in rush hour, you can see literally trains coming back to back to harbor people. It's crazy.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take us back to a moment when you and your parents were walking down the city street together? You're an only child, so just the three of you or other family members with you?
Just three of us. So the street where I grew up is also affectionately called Toy Street because it was just filled with toy stores. I'm thinking, let's see. I'd probably ask my parents if I could buy something every time we walked the subway because, like, we have to leave the street and, like, we walk past every single toy store. I remember whenever I had pocket change, I would just go home from school and I would just go a little further, go get some Pokemon cards, and then go home.
Awesome. Were Beanie Babies in when you were a kid?
Not really. I've seen them. I've definitely seen them growing up, but not in the part where I grew up. I think, you know, I'm looking at a lot of, like, Japanese toys, you know? Japanese cartoons, the best ones always come with toys, or basically they're just toys turned into a cartoon series. So a lot of that kind of stuff.
Do you think that Pokemon influenced your art at all?
No, but it helped me learn a lot of English.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There are a lot of different moves, and, you know, you get to learn words as you're looking at it, you know?
Well, your English is remarkable, and
Thank you. Your
accent almost nil, and I had asked you earlier about how you did that. I wondered if you could share a little bit.
Yeah, so I was kind of an outcast growing up, to be honest with you. I didn't really feel like I fit in this in the popular culture. I didn't really have a lot of friends to relate with in person, so I ended up spending a lot of time on the internet, talking to strangers, learning about the world, arguing with people that don't matter, but it helped me practice.
And was that a typewritten communication, or was there a face-to-face dimension?
There was a lot of typing, and then at some point I grew comfortable with, you know, going on random chat rooms where everyone's, like, on a webcam and just talking. Yeah, so Tiny Chat was, like, a big thing. It's funny because I think I spent a good chunk of my teenage life on the internet, and I've made countless friends. And even to this day, some I still keep in touch with. Some I've lost touch with, which is okay, you know. We grow apart. You know, who we are as a teenager is totally different than who we are now. And if you're not really happy with the association of your teenage connections, so be it.
I mean, world out there.
Yeah, and I've actually met a lot of these folks in person throughout these years.
I bet that's pretty cool.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, you must have friends all over the world thus.
I do. So 4 years ago, I was invited to do a project where I basically was a documentary photographer for a road trip film production. Fondly remember when we got to San Francisco, I hit up one of my longtime friends on the internet, and then we got Korean fried chicken in Chinatown. And then when we hit Maryland, I was right around the area of Silver Springs, Bethesda, and met up with another friend. And that was when, like, Pokemon Go just came out, so we were just walking around and, like, catching Pokemon. It was great.
That's so cool. I'm so glad you shared that. What yeah. a neat thing to get to meet people you've only known on the computer, and you already have a friendship going.
And it's a really interesting experience because, like, you think it's kind of like a blind date, but it's not, because you've already known these folks for so many years, and you know them pretty well. And then when you meet each other, it's not about, oh, so what do you do? It's just like a regular interaction with a friend, except this time it's not over a screen, but in person.
That's a great perspective to bring. I don't think I've ever had that. It's like a pen pal.
Yeah, then it's you a meet lot like a pen pal.
Yeah. So speaking of interesting interactions, you spent about 10 years when you were a child studying classical harmonica. I'm so curious what drew you to that instrument.
So I think growing up, I had a lot of extracurricular activities. I wouldn't say forced upon, but signed up by my parents. Let's put it that way. I never said no. Most of these things I was like okay with, just killed time.
Like what?
I used to play gymnastics. I used to play basketball. I used to rock climb. I know quite a few instruments. The trombone, the violin, the guitar. So just a lot of extracurricular activities. And yeah, there wasn't really a reason why I ended up picking the harmonica, but my dad's kind of a jokester, like all dads are. And
dad humor.
Yeah, basically he would always jokingly tell me, like over dinner, you know, it's good that you're learning harmonica, you know, like practice hard, because like when you're homeless, you know, that's what you're gonna have to play. And then my follow-up joke to that was like, at some point my dad realized the guitar case is bigger, so you could like get more money out of the case. So he like asked me, oh, you should go learn play guitar.
That's funny. Mm-hmm. Keep the harmonica in the little pocket.
Yeah.
So classical harmonica was not an idea I was ever exposed to, and I went online and was floored by how fabulous it is. You can play anything on that little tiny instrument.
Yeah, the biggest difference between what I play, which is what's called a chromatic harmonica, is that it's got a little button on the side, and the button is kind of like the black keys on a piano. So when you look at like vast majority of harmonica players in American music history, they're playing what's called a blues harmonica. 10 holes, there's no sharp notes, flat notes, and they carry a case of them because there's different scales. I don't have to carry a case of them because with the black keys, I can transpose into any scale I want. And by that logic, I open up a lot more possibilities to play a wide range of music. To give you a little bit more of a backstory, I kind of shoved my music practice to the side about a year or two before I started my art education. I basically said, you know, I want to focus on visual art. I think I should focus on something instead of sports or music, which I'm, you know, getting back into these days. But I played a lot of harmonica growing up. It was probably the instrument I know the best, and my teacher was wonderfully kind, a very loving teacher, and he eventually had enough students to start an orchestra. And happy to say that one of my friend, now acquaintance of sorts, who is the concertmaster of the art orchestra back in the day, is a touring world champion. He just plays all over the world. He plays on cruise ships. Probably not so much these days, but...
What's his name?
His name is C.Y. Leo.
Nice. So people could probably look him up if they were interested.
Absolutely. I'm comfortable to say that he's probably the most proficient harmonica player alive right now.
Wow.
And I'd like to reconnect with him someday because I know he's auditioning to go to Berkeley for his master's.
Oh, so
he'd be a lot closer.
You guys could go play Pokemon Go together. Or busk. You could get your harmonicas out and busk. Throw
I'm just there to like clap hands, you know.
So you did choose to focus on your art education. Were you pretty artistic and creative as a child?
I think so. I think I was pretty creative growing up. rumor has it, again, my dad's really good at drawing, but he never draws. So I'm pretty sure I got that from my dad's side, because I have two cousins from my dad's side who also were artists or went to art school. So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, so when did you know you wanted to go to art school?
I knew I wanted to go to art school at a pretty young age. I think, you know, there's always this whole idea of, you know, I want to be an artist, and then my parents would be like, no, you're gonna die poor, and then you're only gonna be famous or rich after you're gone. And then I had to like switch up a little bit. I think I said painter at some point, and they're like, no, same thing. It's just different words. And then I think around when I was 15, I received my first DSLR, and I really got into photography. Got really serious about it, became, to this day, I still consider it a pretty serious hobby and not really entirely a profession, but these days, I think I make more professional work than personal work.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what DSLR is for listeners?
Yeah, so DSLR is digital single lens reflex camera. So you think, you know, when you press a shutter and you hear the clap, clap, clap sound, that's a SLR camera.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak, and the background noise is from Hong Kong. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Joel Sui. He was born and raised in Hong Kong and moved to the United States in 2012 to attend the Maine College of Arts BFA, Bachelor's in Fine Arts program. He stayed on to study at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies, and then completed his master's degree in fine arts at MECA, Maine College of Art. Presently, he's a graduate admissions counselor for MECA. And who else could possibly know more about a school and its program than Joel? This is terrific. What's it like working at your alma mater?
It's pretty fun. I mean, if you've reduced it down to the essentials, I get paid to talk about being in school there. I get paid to talk about art. It's great.
Very cool. I want to talk about you and your creative and conceptual art, which listeners sure can see and hear at www.probablyjoel.com. If you've done some virtual reality work with photography, I wondered if you could describe how this is done. When I went to Probably Joel, I got to watch some of your VR, and I thought, I don't even know how this happened. So if you could make that image come to life for me, I'd be really grateful. And what I'm thinking of for listeners is when you put your hand on the cursor and you can move it around and see 360 in an interview or something like that.
Yeah. So for my undergraduate studies, I was a new media major. So new media, which, I mean, is kind of self-explanatory. You're looking at new stuff, new ways to approach art, is how I perceived it when I was an undergraduate student. And I was kind of running out of ideas. I wasn't sure what I really wanted to do for my thesis project. So I sought to combine my interest in, I really like photographing art for people because it's what I call, it's like a pillow talk with the artwork that you don't really get to experience often. So that was something that I really cherished. And I was thinking of combining the two of them, and I stumbled upon ways to build virtual reality photographs. And that was when the Oculus Rift, which is like this VR headset, just started becoming popular. So I thought to myself, when I produced that project, which was called Alternative Methods to Documenting Art, I didn't really... There weren't any commercially available VR cameras that were production quality. So I kind of thought outside of the box and figured a way to build virtual reality videos. So what I would do is I would take photographs of the space. Say we're in, you know, where we're hearing right now. We're in Wan Chai. I would put a tripod there with a camera, and I would have to carefully take photographs of my surroundings and then stitch it into a full hamster ball of a photograph, right?
That's a good visual, yeah.
And then, to make it more lively, I could add audio to it, but you're still looking at a still image. But if I could make it move, it would be like a video. So what I did was I went, at the same time, I would also select a moment where I know there's movement. And I would start recording that video. And basically, that video gets superimposed on the image to create the illusion that you're actually in a moving virtual reality landscape.
Wow. So the video is played over top of the still.
Yes.
Oh.
But then it's all like flattened out, so it looks as if any VR video that you'll see these days.
Wow. That's really creative.
Thank you.
And you're bringing serious tech knowledge in too, aren't you?
Yeah, and unfortunately I never really pursued it any further because I had other interests. But when I was at SALT, I decided no one's ever made a VR video in the SALT Story Archive, and I want to be the first person, just to call dibs. It wasn't really a strong reason, but I ended up with a subject that had like a perfect location to do a VR story, because they have like this tiny little house full of little trinkets of things that they've collected around the world. And then when you walk outside of the house, it's like this vast seascape of Cape Elizabeth, where they live. So it was just a perfect experience that was serendipitous. But
I watched it for a little while before I realized I could explore it, and it was like a kid opening a gift. You know, I did. Oh, look at this. It was really cool. I'll hot link to it, too, on the website so that people can go right to that story.
I think that's one of my favorite ways. I think what's fun about virtual reality video is equal parts watching it and watching people watch it. Because when they realize they have the freedom to look around, it's like a totally different experience. You start following the character along.
Yeah, it's like a choose your own adventure story where you get to pick if you want to go down to the ocean or if you want to climb up the stairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. Thanks for doing that and being the first at SALT. Has anybody else done any since?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, you're a trailblazer. When we spoke this week, you said sound is half a movie. And I thought about that a lot. I suppose it is, but quite the less obvious part. I wonder if you could share your passion for sound and music and how you let that play through your work.
Yeah, so I think one of the more formative moments of my undergraduate education was I had a filmmaking professor, Gary Robinoff. He is a documentary filmmaker, producer. He doesn't live in Maine anymore. We still keep in touch loosely, but he is the person why I was drawn to documentary works. He's the person why I got acquainted with SALT Institute. So I always think back about how, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I was like, I want to, you know, be a SALT alum someday. And then today, I'm really proud to be one of the folks who helped shape SALT's future. So that's something that's kind of theatrical to me.
Yeah, and here to the teachers of the world who change people, change your trajectory in life.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Gary. Do you expect to make other documentary films in your future?
Not so much. So, ironically, despite the fact that I'm predominantly an image maker, I occasionally go help out different institutions and courses on documentary film because I have like the fundamental skills to teach it, but I'm really not that interested in it. So my master's thesis was equal parts talking about diaspora and how migration is represented in mass media, but also equal parts looking at documentary more closely situated with fine art than journalism. And for me, that's important because I see documentary less hinged to journalism and more to fine art. So my thesis research was a lot about looking at contemporary artists who actively embody a documentarian role. So basically, they're having a very specialized role of narrating history through the lens of fine art versus narrating history through the lens of politics or journalism.
Wow. That's a beautiful answer, and it's just making my mind reel right now. Thinking of documentary as more fine art than journalism.
I think one of the things that I always cite is John Grierson. In the 30s, when documentary became a word, one of the things he brought up was documentary is a creative treatment of actuality, and like those words just stuck with me all these years. I learned about those words from Salt, and I brought it over to my master's research. And to this day, I still think of it. Like, what if we put more of an emphasis on creative treatment and less of an emphasis on pure actuality? Because if you think about it, all journalism is more akin to documentary in the sense that you're still telling a story and you still have a stance. Without a story, without a stance, you're presenting statistics. Right. Documentary is not just statistics.
You're bringing it to life. Mm-hmm. And you do it with sound and images. Joel, you are a great example of a modern artist, skilled and creative with new technologies and making products that are interactive and enrich our human experience, like today's background cityscapes that people are hearing right now from Wan Chai, Hong Kong. I wish you the best as you use these talents to continue to create.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
It's such a pleasure. And thank you all for listening. If you would like to hear this complete interview or interviews from previous weeks, please visit newmainerspeak.com. I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Joel has selected for us. I wonder if you could tell us why you chose this song before we play it.
Yeah, so this is an easy pick. One of my best friends, Mike, is a music producer on the side, and I really like his music. I often say that, you know, his music is how I see the world and how I make photographs.
Lovely. So, and what's the name of this piece?
He makes music under the name Grey Hat, and this song is called Rolling from his EP Tens.